Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. In a universe that seems to contain 2 trillion or more galaxies, that is expanding to God knows where, a quadrennial presidential election on a peewee marvel of a planet on the fringe of a middling galaxy probably doesn't count for much in a cosmic sense. But it does mean quite a lot to the fraction of us puny human beings who are an aggregate of nearly 10 billion of our single species sprawled all over our little spinning ball like maggots on a peach. This incredibly grueling and interminable presidential election, which had its beginning in the dim long ago, approaches its cataclysmic climax period these next few weeks. Soon, despite promises and the usual false collegial memories of campaigns past, the political implosion of fear, hate, and loathing will illuminate the final pre-election period all the way up to the ballot box. The world has changed in a day. Its repercussions will be felt for a century, perhaps slowly or impatiently, but it is now tilting downslope into a darkness reminiscent of civil wars, inquisition, and barbarous despotism. Like time and space is theorized to be, the election of Donald Trump as president of the USA might be considered emergent phenomena from the darkest malignancies of perceived psychosis, fundamentally capable of perpetrating horrible inhumanities, which are, after all, particularly human, however monstrous and savage. Trump and his alt-right cabal are predators of an atavistic kind, despite veils of simplistic frontier pieties and righteousness, and they will soon have hands on the grotesquely destructive forces concocted by humanity in its short, bitter existence on this third planet from the sun. Their emergent phenomena seems predestined by the earlier Republican presidencies of Nixon, Reagan, Bush, and Bush-Cheney that softened up the constitutional process for Trump and his Morlocks to rape, pillage, and plunder. Though disgraced, the Nixonians prepared the way for Reaganomics and the Bush II holy oil wars, the onerous ideology of rich over poor, and the relentless torment of the poor for being poor. This is the Republican Revolution, Alexander Hamilton Trump's Thomas Jefferson, the essential and eternal struggle of American democracy, plutocratic aristocracy versus equality and liberty. The so-called populist neoconservative ideology, elected under the guise of democracy, is similar to the National Socialism, which immediately destroyed German democracy in the 1930s. Trump and his associates are not unlike the Hitler regime that once it got power, it had to race to control everything before anyone could recover or gain enough strength to successfully resist them. Under the Trump Reich, our truly revolutionary ancestors would undoubtedly be barred access to the republic they founded. It seems we are more fractious and divisive than since the beginning of the Civil War. Our argument is still the same, race and gender, framed in terms of wealth. The alt-white supremacist manosphere is determined to start a second civil war, but their obsessive conservatism is fueled by shadowy fat cat autocrats who covertly support their bitter misogyny, who are the real counter-revolutionaries. If these particular sounds and furies resonate with Election 2000, they are instead a few blusters of mine before and after the infamous election of 2016, when nearly everything constituting democracy was humpty-trumptied. The most egregious element of this 2020 campaign is the onerous attempt by Trump and his cabal to discredit and ultimately to abolish the vote, which is obviously the most basic fundament of democratic governance. In just a single 4-year term, Trump has shriveled nearly everything civil and just in the USA, not to mention his virtual, deathly negligence of the ravaging virus that is sickening millions and killing hundreds of thousands in the USA and world at large, which he has apparently contracted and claims to have heroically outdone. Trump's boastful posture of male virility is true on one account at least. He is virusly viral. Serendipity has many definitions as well as implications not entirely pleasant. On today's date, October 8, 1998, the U.S. House of Representatives voted to conduct impeachment hearings against President Bill Clinton for perjury, obstruction of justice, witness tampering, and abuse of power in connection with an extramarital affair in the White House. Trump and Clinton have that in common, also that both were acquitted. You might say with prejudice and no little partisan corruption, as was the first and only other so far impeached president, Andrew Johnson, the assassinated Lincoln's successor nearly a century and a half ago. To commemorate today's anniversary of Clinton's escape from justice 22 years ago, today's program is a satire I wrote during the 1996 presidential election between Clinton and Robert Dole for my now expired dodo of a newspaper, the North Coast Times Eagle. I last read it on the air during the last electoral debacle 4 years ago. It is a product of my imagination and not intended to malign, but poke parody and perhaps a dose of grim ridicule, and represents no other opinion in the new universal galactic order. Even the famous and notorious Top of the Aster is fictitious. I call it the transmutation of Billy Bob. And I start it. Talleyrand is said to have been asked his opinion of Voltaire and Robespierre, and to have replied, "When I think of one, I prefer the other." Bill Clinton and Bob Dole met secretly in Astoria in a small banquet room of the famous and always popular Top of the Aster. I discovered their meeting because I was waiting tables at that stage of my recovery from financial disaster, which was less a result of the shift of wealth from the many to the few, as it was a couple of unwise personal decisions that left me broke and underemployed for several months. "Guess who's breaking bread together?" I said to my friend Rio Rita, who was behind the bar. "Let me guess, oral and hardly," she said. I looked at her sharply. "How did you know?" I was an impertinent and surly waiter, quite surprised to be employed at Astoria's most posh drinking and dining emporium, which is 8 stories above the city's downtown streets and commands a splendid view of the Columbia River and the ascending hills clustered with lovely old Carpenter Gothic houses and churches. From the top floor is visible the site of Fort Astor, the city's birthplace. My previous experience as a waiter was in a gag and barf place called Spike's Bisque and Burger, where the help greeted every customer with a snarling, "What the barnacles do you want?" My customers are rustic squires who made their money in fish and timber and whose artistic pretensions are quenched by endless community theater presentations of old Broadway musicals. You never knew when the tables filled with after-theater patrons would suddenly erupt into song, which I dreaded. Like almost everyone on Earth who has no clue as to what must be done to maintain a grasp upon this elusive world, and in reasonable fear of the few who think they know the answers, I collect information which sometimes I am able to synthesize and pass on through my esoteric little newspaper, a perennial cause of my subsistence below the poverty line, an ardently opinionated public radio program. So readers and listeners can sympathize with my reaction to seeing Clinton and Dole sitting at the same table in the same room, in the same restaurant, in a small out-of-the-way city in the northwest corner of the lower 48, as Astoria its only distinction, that is the oldest city in the American West. Their private banquet room was dominated by a window that overlooked the Columbia River, named for the great navigator who missed India by half a world and known to history as the Great River of the West. Astoria's annual regatta was at full sail and throttle. Boats of various sizes, shapes, and purposes paraded along the waterfront, festooned with banners and flags, while the land parade marched past the city's skyscraper, named after John Jacob Astor, a vintage 8-story mass of white plaster that started out as a popular hotel after a fire devastated Astoria's heart in 1922. It almost fell to the wrecking ball or egregious implosion, except that a few visionaries realized that a fancy first water restaurant and nightclub on the top floor would bring prosperity to the city after half a century of decline, because the fish were gone and the forest clear-cut to stumps. This was represented by the publicly subsidized poverty apartments on the lower floors. The noise of bands, horns, and sirens rose in thermal waves through the open window at the top of the Astor, drowning out much of the dialogue between the two candidates vying to be the last American president of the 20th century. I admired their calculated anonymity in a backwater Northwest city at a moment when it was packed with locals and tourists who would never notice them in a crowd. My news hound curiosity and suspicion were piqued by the purpose of their clandestine parley. What I was able to hear of their intense, cryptic conversation gave me the heartsick realization that the incumbent and his political poltergeist were tearing up the Constitution. They were alone in the banquet room that was profitably developed for the use of lovers and intriguers who could afford the high price of privacy. But as I watered them and took their order, I was aware I had been critically inspected by several unusually alert diners at tables bunched near the room's entrance. I wondered if I had been quickly frizzed and spot-checked, or if the conspiring candidates accepted the rare possibility their waiter might be an assassin as an unavoidable risk. The first few times I approached their table, they hushed, but after a half dozen trips with water, soup, slop, and bourbon, they continued jabbering as though I was simply mobile furniture, a prologue to a future dependency upon servile robots. Almost as mechanically, I converted my journalist brain into a recording device, locking each word into a dialectic cocoon, and worried if I had enough cerebral capacity to store Clinton's verbiage. I heard very little of the conversation because I spent most of the time en route between kitchen, bar, and table. But I was able to hear the last several minutes when they ignored my loitering around a serving cart in which I freighted dessert and lattes. Dole sat stiff and starchy. His face was pasty and looked like too many facelifts gone awry. Clinton smiled and stared at him with the expectant cheerfulness of a snake about to swallow a rabbit. They talked insistently, dull, crisp, and spare. His voice had a hard-edged whine, often accusatory and self-righteous. Clinton rambled in a folksy fog of alphabet soup that seemed to include in its broth reference to most of the sciences as well as religions, economics, and social peculiarities of most of the world's cultures. Dole's sights seemed clearer, but lacked the vision thing, as an equally eloquent George Bush Sr. called it. He seemed to be counting pebbles while Clinton built a shining mountain for humanity to ascend. Clinton was a great disappointment. Slick Willie, friends as well as enemies called him. "He's never inhaled," one of my friends said of him, disgusted that he failed to stand up for liberal policies he promised to implement, and because he steals the conservative thunder from its adherents, such as signing a stingy welfare law that impoverishes children and punishes single mothers. A few of his detractors and friends called him the Muhammad Ali of modern politics. Float like a butterfly, sting like a bee. He and Dole were described as creatures of Oz. Clinton said to have no spine, Dole no heart. Clinton loves to press flesh, claims he lives in the crown jewel of the nation's penal system, the White House, always under guard with every visitor strip-searched, especially after two trespassers seemed inspired to terminate his presidency. He pressed Dole's flesh with his voice, intimate and charming, which disarmed Dole as much as it also did me. Dole either ignored me or did not register my presence. Yet Clinton seemed to let me feel he was aware and pleased I was serving him. I had to remain low-key and generally unnoticed, an invisibility similar to black-clad Japanese no puppeteers, if I wished to discover the real purpose of this meeting. "I'm going to win, Bob," I heard Clinton say. "The only real chance you've got of beating me is that crazy supply-sider Jack Kemp, but that's a long shot," Clinton smiled coyly. "That little stroke of genius raised you a couple of points in the polls, but not enough to win, Bob, and you're stuck with him. If by some miracle you do beat me, he will make your life a living hell. You might just die to be rid of him, and guess who is president then?" he asked facetiously. That prospect seriously worried Dole. He still smarted from Kemp's remark about his library burning down, his two books burned, one of which he hadn't finished coloring. Dole's retort was that Kemp, a former pro footballer, had played without his helmet, which was originally quipped about another Republican and former gridiron star who did become president, but not elected, Gerald Ford, who was also accused of not being able to walk and chew gum simultaneously, a slam against his left-handedness. A joke was that his first lady, Betty Ford, practiced birth control by giving him a stick of gum before bedtime. "Everything is political," my friend the dish dog shouted at the cook, a large, genial redneck he loved to argue with, as I bumped into the kitchen with a tray of dirty dishes. The dish dog was a poet and an acute political philosopher. Encountering with him anywhere was generally unsettling as well as illuminating. "Are we really so stupid as to seriously consider two rich white guys as the only suitable candidates for president in this whole polyglot country?" he growled at me, slamming trays of dishes into an automatic dishwasher that immediately wreathed him in clouds of steam. "We're governed by pious hypocrites who are mostly white troglodyte males in a country in which women are the majority and the great variety of other races vastly outnumber Anglos. Country club apartheid," he spat disgustedly. The dish dog's theory, which he expounded as often as anyone would listen, was that the white race is historically dead, and despite the virulent angst of skinheads and white supremacist militias, none will be left in the world in two centuries. Of course, he was so white he was almost pink, but he loved to say to his diminishing number of Caucasian acquaintances, "I am extinct. You are extinct." "You ought to think about becoming a Republican," he said drolly as I was about to kick my way out the door with a load of grub for the contenders. "Because Dole or Kemp said Republicans won't tolerate despair in the cities anymore. If they win, you can join me in the line of good-hearted fellows trying to get hired as officers of the Joy Police." I was out again, back into the conversation, if only briefly, and without contextual bridges. I could only guess, yet a pattern emerged. Clinton earnestly cajoled Dole to agree that the current two-party system was kaput, obsolete, and inefficient. Slick Willy stuff. I couldn't see his point. Where was he going? Why this secret meeting? "Two political parties don't represent the people any more than Congress, the White House, or Wall Street," the dish dog said my next trip to the kitchen. He was steam clouded from the dishwashing machine and seemed to look through me while he ranted. "People talk about wanting a third party as if we have a two-party system. We don't. We've got one big party with two fat heads. Problem is, most people get disgusted and stop voting, especially the people most adversely affected, and that simply perpetuates the problems." "The era of big government is over," Clinton said when I was back in the banquet room with his assorted junk food and Dole's rubber chicken. "Everything is for sale to the private sector, except the Pentagon. Even welfare is going to be privatized. Poverty is profitable," he chuckled. "The commies were right," the dish dogs said, blurred in hot fog. "International class war is replacing nationalism. The whole new world order we are designing is a direct schism between rich and poor. Those are the only political parties that count, the rich party and the poor party." Back in the banquet room, I heard Clinton say to Dole while I busied about the serving cart, "Bob, some of our mutual friends are getting tired of duplicating expenses. That's why they suggested we do lunch," he said, talking with full mouthfuls of cheeseburger. "We got to face reality, Bob. The Democratic and Republican parties are for all political purposes the same party," Clinton said, swallowing cheeseburger with bourbon as mouthwash. "We share the same interests and worldviews when you cut through the hog spit. We share the same sponsors who really don't care which one of us is president. It'll still be business as usual, except one of us loses." Clinton leaned back in his chair and lit one of his famous cigars. "Neither one of us have to lose, Bob," he said expansively, blowing smoke over Dole's head. "The smartest thing for both of us to do is consolidate, target the centers of our parties, and let go the radical fringes. We don't want to go chasing after the minorities, ideologues, and nutcases. We got to put up with the women, but we can let the rest go. Let Perot and Nader have them." "We have to be bold and realistic," Clinton said, biting lustily into a dripping piece of pizza. "We can share the really big money without it being divided between separate campaigns. Bob Dole doesn't want the American people to think he will ever be a part of anything that destroys traditional values," Dole said. "Cork the cod swallop," Clinton said affably, puffing on the cigar between pizza bites. "You're here because you know you can't win. You want a deal, and you hope I asked you here to give you a good one. The most cherished American value is winning," Clinton drawled. "Why should either of us risk losing when we can win together?" "Are you suggesting we betray our parties?" Dole asked starchily. "We will form a super party that can't be beat," Clinton said. "But the only way this deal can work is that I remain president." Dole started to protest, but Clinton put his hand on his arm. "Listen, Bob, Veep is the closest you're ever going to get to the White House. I'm offering you a chance that'll work for both of us and kick Kemp's butt out." "What about Gore?" Dole asked suspiciously. Clinton shrugged. "Al will have to find his own way to the new age of Aquarius," he said languidly. I was appalled. Surely Dole would treat that most cynical and corrupt proposition with the contempt it deserved. Instead, his sour face broke into a childlike, almost beatific smile. He stared at Clinton with a look of bedazzled enchantment on his face and could not have expressed any better his delight and wonder, as if a door had been opened for him to enter an entirely new world of giddy new possibilities. I thrust myself at their table. "Are you completely insane?" I shouted at their surprised faces. I started hyperventilating in a flurry of explosive verbosity. "The right wing and the left wing fanatics will start a revolution against the government at the same time they will fight a civil war against each other. There will be a racial bloodbath that will dwarf the slaughter in Rwanda. You're creating catastrophe out of chaos. You're acting as cynical and corrupt as everybody expects and accuses you of, and you'll be the first the mob comes after. They'll have your guts for neckties." The door burst open. A number of armed diners, some with napkins tucked under their chins, packed the doorway and pointed a variety of automatic weapons at me. I stared at them, then glanced angrily at the two conspirators. Dole was startled and angry at my outburst, but not Slick Willie. He sat back with a greasy chicken thigh in his hand. "It's evolution," he said with a wide, friendly smile. "Naturally, natural selection of the political process. You might say we are building a bridge to the 21st century." At that very moment, the righteously fiery ghost of William Jennings Bryan took possession of my soul and tongue. I stood stiffly and glared at them imperiously as I heard myself say in ringing basso the final words of the second most famous American speech, which he thunderously orated a century ago in 1896, perhaps the last time a political party was truly populist. "You shall not press upon the brow of labor this crown of thorns. You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold." I stared down at them like an angered god, snapped my head up with a snort of disgust, and shoved my cart out of the room and through the cluster of spooks and bodyguards. "Do you know what those bastards are doing?" I shouted at the dish dog as I slammed open the kitchen door. "What two bastards?" he asked. "They're ripping apart the Constitution." "Who? Who do you think I'm talking about?" I said. "They're here. They're right here in downtown Astoria, plotting a political coup that will destroy the country." "Am I supposed to guess at the identities of these mystery guests?" the dish dog said. I told him everything, stunned at the audacity and enormous consequences of what I overheard. The only way democracy can survive is by keeping a balance between conflicting factions and allow none of them to get such power as to be capable of suppressing or persecuting the rest, the dish dog said seriously. "That's what I told them," I said ingenuously, "but they don't give a damn. They're selling out the country for their own selfish and imperial ambitions." "All politics are local," the dish dog said to me as I stuck food orders to a rack next to the grill. "You should write political satire," he said. "You could change half the world with political satire." "I don't want to change the world," I said as I watched him disappear in a steaming cloud. "I just want to know what the hell is going on. The only real political question is who's getting screwed and who's doing the screwing," I heard his muffled voice through the steam cloud. This is Michael McCusker. The engineer is Dylan Hauser Schalk. Stay safe. Protecting yourself protects everybody else. Surviving the plague is not a guerrilla-style chest-trumping exercise, but is instead a community collective necessity of empathetic survival. We'll be right back.